Given the number of diets we engage in and the number of times we engage in them, it's plain to see we need someone to lead the way. And so today we pause to ask, for whom should we vote to lead us to the promised land of good food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 936th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Accordalia who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. But whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Hello, Aaron.
Hello.
Aaron.
Yes.
For whom should we vote?
For whom we feel worthy.
Okay. Also with us, producer Kelly Bayer. Kelly, welcome.
Howdy.
Who should we vote for?
The people that we trust the most.
Okay, there you go. The people that we trust the most. Good answers. Well, folks, fortunately, this is an off year, which means there are no major elections to distract us from considering the politics of food. Of course, we could discuss the politics of food in an election year, but then our considerations would be hardened by you being on one side of the fence, me on the other, and the both of us throwing apples across the fence at each other. So here we are with no apples in hand, nor any kind of political fence to divide us, to calmly discuss how to vote for someone or something to lead us to the eating of good food. Given the number of diets we engage in and the number of times we engage in those diets and the fact that we as a people keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger and require more and more and more medical care, it's plain to see we need someone or something to lead the way. And so we ask, should we vote for Democrats? Should we vote for Republicans? Should we vote for something else? For whom should we vote to lead us to the promised land of good food? And hey, who better to ask than Professor Marion Nessel, author of Eat, Drink, and Vote. Marion, welcome to the Food Chain.
Oh, glad to be here.
Glad to have you back. Been a little while since we had you, and you're still a professor of food studies and public health at New York University?
I sure am. And teaching food policy this semester.
Food policy, which of course is related directly to food politics, right?
Absolutely. Well, it's actually food policy and politics, and it's about how governments make laws and regulations that can either promote health or not promote health, and what the politics of all that is, and there's plenty of it.
And that's what we like to get into today. And don't you think it's a fun time to discuss politics in an off year when there's no election to distract us, so we can kind of, well, step back from being a Republican or step back from being a Democrat and say, let's think about this, you know, before we become fully engaged in throwing apples at each other across the backyard fence.
Well, I live in New York, and we have an election for mayor going on that's hotly contested and very much Republican versus Democrat, and a lot of food issues are at stake.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, then we'll bear that in mind. The rest of the country can bear that in mind as we go through this subject. Well, you know, you're also, incidentally, the blogger, principal blogger at foodpolitics.com, correct?
I am.
So we can always tune into Marion Nessel at foodpolitics.com. Broad brush.
I tweet it, Marion Nessel.
Okay, and tweet it, Marion Nessel. Broad brush, Marion. What exactly do we mean by the politics of food when we say the politics? What does that mean?
Well, it has to do with different opinions about food issues and the way those opinions are organized and exercised. Lobbying is the most obvious example. Food is a more than $1 trillion a year business in the United States alone. So there's a huge amount of money at stake in what people buy and what foods they choose to eat. So anytime the government or a public health agency makes a recommendation for what would be healthier for people to eat, the foods that are in the eat more category, the people who make those foods are really happy about it. But the people who make the foods that are not in that category are very unhappy about it. And I suppose the best example, or the most recent example, was this week's new Let's Move campaign from the White House to drink more water. The unstated message in drink more water is drink less soda. And the complicated political part of that is that soda companies own bottled water companies. And so there's very mixed and confusing stuff going on here.
I guess politics makes strange drinking buddies then, right?
It makes very strange drinking buddies.
Oh, yeah,
it's not simple at all.
Yeah, and you know, it even goes to the smallest of things, I guess, because I was reading the Wall Street Journal this morning, and there was an article about quinoa, which is a grain from quinoa. Okay.
Quinoa.
Thank you very much.
Quinoa.
Everybody's corrected me that three times today, so I'll get quinoa, which is a grain, okay? It would seem like that would be a very simple thing to consider. We can put the quinoa on the table, and we can subject it to political analysis. But the story was about how some people are just fed up with everybody else trying to get them to eat quinoa. I don't want to eat quinoa. I hate it, they say. And so now there's this wonderful rabble going on over quinoa. This, something so very simple. And it seems
It's symbolic. I mean, one of the things about food, you take food into your body, and it's enormously intimate. So people take food very personally, as well they should. And lots of people don't like being told what to eat. I happen to like quinoa, but the politics of quinoa go way beyond people not being one or being told what to eat it. It has to do with the fact that the where quinoa is grown is in very low-income Latin American countries, where that's part of the native diet, but because it's now being grown for export, the price has gone up, and the people who used to survive on it can't eat it anymore. That's where the politics comes in.
So it would seem like no matter where we turn or what kind of food we put on the table for consideration, there is a political consideration.
Absolutely. That's why it's so much fun.
Yeah, what reminds me of Mark Twain's, whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting. So I guess you could say pretty much the same thing about food then, true?
Food is for fighting, absolutely. Yeah, so the new book with the cartoons in it is to try to interject a little sense of humor into all of that.
And you use cartoons when you lecture too, don't you? How do you present?
Oh, always.
How do you go about presenting the politics of food?
Well, I talk about the big issues. The big public health issues in the world today are not having enough food and having too much food. So it's one of the great ironies of our food system is that the two biggest problems with it are that lots of people don't have enough, and there are political reasons for that. And some people have too much and are eating too much, and I think there are political reasons for that too, although those are much harder for people to see. So all you have to do is start talking about, or all I have to do is start talking about the reasons why people started to gain weight in the early 1980s and talk about the enormous social and political changes that took place around that time that made such a big difference in the way our food system works. And people get it right away. It's just that most people have never thought about these food in these kinds of terms. Lots of people are surprised that there are any political aspects of what they eat. But the minute they start thinking about it, they get it right away. Hmm. And I think cartoons help.
And cartoons help pick them up and get them thinking. Well, you know, we're going to have to take a quick break here in a moment, but when we come back, I'd like to start our discussion with what you just mentioned about the fact that why don't we think about food in political terms? And why are we so confused when we start thinking about food in political terms? This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today, folks, we're taking a look at the politics of food and how those politics shape what we eat and the kind of shape how we look when we look in the mirror and go, oh my goodness, what happened to me? And politics has a lot to do with that. And so we're trying to come to grips with that by asking some questions such as, why are we so confused about the foods we eat? How do various interest groups vie to control what we eat and think about our food? And for whom should we vote to lead us to the promised land of good food? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back with Marion Nessel.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
I guess we could file this question under Michael Olson's second law of the food chain, which is, the farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over our food. Which leads us to the question, why are we so confused about the food we eat? Marion, it seems like we should be able to put food like quinoa on the table and say, well, it's made up of this and it's made up of that, and our body needs this and our body needs that, so this is a good or not a good food. But not so. It seems like we're always confused. Why is that?
Well, because there are lots of vested interests in keeping us confused, to put it most cynically. Eating couldn't be more simple. If you want to eat a healthy diet, make sure you have plenty of plant-based foods, fruits, vegetables, grains in your diet. You balance your calories, and you don't eat too much junk food. It really isn't any more complicated than that. If it seems complicated, it's because the research looks at foods from a nutritional standpoint and looks at nutrients individually, even though that's not how people eat. People eat foods which have lots and lots of nutrients. And because the companies that sell the food have an enormous vested interest in making sure that you buy their products and eat more of their products than you do of other products. Eat mine, not theirs, and eat more of mine. And from a business standpoint, and I think that business standpoint has thoroughly confused the entire food marketplace so that people think that they're supposed to be eating products that are advertised with literally billions of dollars a year.
Mm-hmm. Is there any way to know what the exact nutrient requirements are of the human body at any given point in time? The reason I ask, Marion, is because I heard this program talking about you have to supplement with calcium at night. And I'm going, oh, geez.
I'm not a supplement person, so I'm the wrong person to ask
about
that.
But in considering that notion, And considering the politics of food and how information is used, I just wonder if there's any way of knowing exactly what we need when we need it.
Yeah, it's one of the things I love about nutrition, and not everybody does, is that it's gray and never black and white. You can never have precision because it's impossible to measure these kinds of things. Or it's so difficult and expensive to measure that nobody can afford to do it. What you have is a phenomenal amount of research that has been summarized in thousands of pages of work put out by the Institute of Medicine in Washington on human nutritional requirements. The books are called the Dietary Reference Intakes, and there's 6 volumes of them. They're absolutely enormous, and they're impossible to read. And what they have tried to do is to get average population-based nutrient requirements, and those you can do. You absolutely can do that. And then most people, that is 99% of the population, the requirements will fall into those ranges. That's really the best you can do. And the amazing thing about it is that diets all over the world, millions of different kinds of combinations of food, all provide the nutrients that people need for optimum health. If you eat a reasonable diet, you're going to do just fine and you don't have to worry about it. You never have to worry about individual nutrients. And you can't worry about individual nutrients because there's so many of them and they interact.
Explain the interaction because when you supplement, yeah, when somebody says, you need calcium, but then calcium interacts with other minerals as well. And then,
yeah, if you look at metabolism and the way that metabolism is the processing of food and nutrients in the body, if you look at metabolism, it takes many, many different vitamins and minerals and nutrient components in order to process the use of any one nutrient in the body. So calcium doesn't exist by itself. It exists in conjunction not only with vitamin D, which helps it absorb it, but also with the B vitamins and various kinds of minerals that are involved in the enzyme systems that use calcium in the body. So you never can look at them individually, but it's too hard to look at them in conjunction. And so scientists are forced either to look at nutrients individually, which is always misleading, or to look at them in animals, which may or may not be misleading, depending on how similar the systems are. So you never are working with perfect knowledge. You're always working with the totality of the evidence and trying to make sense of the totality of the evidence. That's a very difficult concept to get across.
So in other words, like to know exactly what you need, you'd have to drag a mainframe computer along behind you with a wagon and feed in all the information so that
you would need to be in a hospital metabolic ward, incarcerated, in which everything you ate, drank, and did during the day were measured. I mean, this is just for calories. If you want to know about calories, that's what you have to do. You have to put people in machines.
So it's just impossible. So what we do is, as you have said, we seek to find a balanced diet of essentially as many different nutrient sources as we can and enjoy life.
Yeah, I mean, enjoy life. Food is one of life's greatest pleasure. And the secret of a balanced diet is to eat lots of different kinds of foods that are relatively unprocessed. And really, that's all there is to it. And you can throw a little junk food in on top of it. That's fine. Junk food meaning foods that have had a lot of the nutrients taken out or have been processed in ways that are pretty extreme. But the basis of the diet should be real foods and relatively unprocessed foods and lots of different kinds of them. If you vary the diet a lot, the nutrients will take care of themselves.
And then you try to
balance calories.
It's interesting what you said about junk food. We have a local county fair going on right now, and the people who put the fair on did a survey. and asked fair attendees, do you want us to get rid of the junk food and have only healthy food?
Are you kidding?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Go to fairs.
90% said, get real. No way. That's...
I want my deep fat fried butter.
Yes, exactly what we had.
That's my favorite.
Well, I tried deep fat fried alligator, so that was my taste treat.
Oh, yeah? How was it?
Well, you know, it was surprisingly good. It was a Cajun food booth, and it would just go, oh, my goodness.
Uh-huh.
I'm ashamed of myself at how good it was. But let's go to the hard, get into the hard questions now with respect to the food politics. And the other question, how do various interest groups go about controlling how we think about our food?
Well, they work behind the scenes.
Okay. You speak of stakeholder groups. What exactly is a stakeholder? I mean, is it somebody with a T-bone steak in their hand?
No, it's S-T-A-K. It's a steak in their heart. Different steak. That's the jargon word for special interest groups.
Okay.
Groups who have special interest in a particular kind of issue. Let's pick sodas, for example, because they're easy to talk about, because they're sugars and water and nothing else, and truly easy to talk about. You should have less, not more. So soda companies lobby Congress, and they lobby Congress on many, many issues. They lobby Congress not only on dietary guidelines, trying to encourage congressional representatives never to say anything, and federal agencies never to say anything negative about mm-hmm. sodas. And they're pretty successful in that. So that the Let's Move campaign that came out this week says drink water. It doesn't say don't drink sodas.
So there's
even though that's what it means.
When we get back from this break, I have another stakeholder diversity that I'd like to put on the table. And I ran across it at the biotech convention in Chicago. On one side of the table, you have those who are manufacturing genetically modified organisms. On the other side, those who eat them. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Marion Nessel. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Do stay tuned. We are talking about stakeholders in the politics of food. And recently I had the opportunity to speak at the International Biotech Convention in Chicago. The audience essentially were members of the biotech industry. And I was on a panel of farmers and consumer advocates. And I guess fortuitously, I was sitting right between a president of the American Corn Growers Association and a consumer advocate. And both sides of this issue were clearly defined right there. And at the end, when we were asked to summarize our thoughts, my presentation to the biotech industry was something like this. You folks in the biotech industry have this magical new technology at your hand by which you can allow farmers like the one sitting next to me to grow 1,000 acres of corn with no weeds and no pests. And so you have made agriculture very, very happy. And I know how happy they are because I was once a teenage herbicide and weeded the fields of Montana in the hot sun. So I know how miserable that is. So these people are very happy with your technology. And you are very happy with the technology because you're getting very wealthy by virtue of it. But yet, what about these consumers over here on the other side? What have you given them but food to eat that has been drenched in herbicides and infused with pesticides? So there's these two stakeholders in this political war over genetically modified foods. Is that a fair description? What do you think?
Oh, the genetically modified food problem. Everybody thinks it's a safety problem. I think it's much, much more than that. I think the genetically modified food issue is one about who controls the food supply, who makes the decisions. And the biotechnology industry has made terrible, terrible mistakes with respect to trying to get established in the world. One was not making products that anybody really needs, and the other was not labeling them. a very big problem.
But isn't it the perfect issue by which to discuss the politics of food? Because you have these two very clearly defined interest groups. And, you know, when you think about it from the farmer perspective, having the ability to grow crops with no pests and no weeds, wow. I mean, oh, my goodness.
And also fewer pesticide applications. They don't, I mean, as long, to the extent that the chemical Roundup, the herbicide Roundup, continues to work, and there are real questions about that, they don't have to apply the pesticide as often. And that's one of the reasons why farmers have absolutely leaped to get involved in this. And, you know, you have to look at the facts, which are that 80 to 95% of corn, soybeans, cotton, and sugar beets in the United States are genetically modified, grown in the United States.
And it's a very good deal for farmers, and it's a very good deal for the people who manufacture the seeds. Everybody's very happy. And so why shouldn't consumers be happy to eat food that has been drenched in herbicides and infused with pesticides? What's their problem?
Well, they're eating foods that are drenched in herbicides and pesticides anyway. If they're eating normal, run-of-the-mill, conventionally, industrially grown food, that's what they're eating. There's some argument that Roundup is a less toxic pesticide than some of the other ones, and so it has some advantages. It certainly doesn't last as long in the soil. But it's the idea, I think, the values about it that I think so disturb people, that this is messing around with nature, that these decisions are being made without any kind of consumer control. You have to eat, if you eat any kind of conventionally grown fruit or vegetable, you're eating something that's or any kind of processed food, you are likely to be eating something that's been genetically modified, even though there aren't very many fruits and vegetables that are genetically modified that are actually on the market. It's mostly corn, soybeans, cotton, and sugar.
So if you see anything essentially that says, if you look at the ingredients and you see anything that says soy lecithin.
You have to assume that it's genetically modified unless it's organic or it says it's non-GMO.
Okay. So, well, regardless of which side, there are two sides and a political conflict here over the use of GMOs. We have one side that is totally in favor of it, and the other one's side is going, well, not so sure. And I want to know whether that I want to know whether these things are in my food. And so we have an issue. What do we do? Let's label it. Now, there's the conflict. So how do we decide whether to label it?
Here's where the politics come in, and here's where power politics come in. I've read that Monsanto has put more than $4 million into opposing the labeling law in the state of Washington, and it certainly put astonishingly more than that into the labeling law in California. There are so many of these labeling laws popping up that sooner or later one of them is going to pass. And that will start, I think, a situation where more of them will pass. I was on the FDA Food Advisory Committee in 1994 when the issue of labeling genetically modified foods was raised in the first place. I was a consumer representative, and there were four of us who were consumer representatives on this committee, and we said, look, you have to label it. You just absolutely have to. If you don't label it, you're going to raise questions in the public about why you're not labeling it. If this stuff is so good and you're so proud of it, why are you hiding it? What are you trying to hide? And what surprises me is how long it took to get to this point. It's been 20 years. I would never have guessed it would take that long, but it has. And finally, everybody has woken up to the fact that these things are out there. There are uncertainties about them. And people want to know. To me, it seems like a completely simple issue. Consumers want to know. Tell them.
Mm-hmm.
What's the big deal?
Well, that's the question. Why is it such a big deal? And how did they make it such a big deal? And how do we unscramble it? Who do we vote for that will come in and say, let's do this? Do you think it will
here's where the politics come in and get really ugly.
Well, hold on. I want you to hold that until we get back. We have to take a quick break.
Okay.
So I don't want you to spill the beans. Bring people back with them. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. Hey, who are we going to vote for to lead us to the promised land of good food? Republicans? Democrats? Something else? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson with Marion Nessel. And you, who should we vote for? So who do we tune to lead us out of this wilderness of food confusion and through the world of food politics to the world of good food? Marion Nessel, we were talking about where the power politics come in. Where do they come in?
Well, money talks, and these corporations have far more money than consumer advocates. And they go to Congress and lobby, and they lobby on many different kinds of issues, anything that might affect the cost of their production or the acceptance of their production. And at this point, given the Congress that we have now, and I think we need to be really realistic about the Congress that we have now, it can't even pass a farm bill. So to ask this, and it's trying to cut food stamps, so to try to ask this Congress to do anything intelligent about the food system, it seems to me, is asking a lot. So I think at this point we look to grassroots democracy, grassroots political action. I don't really see any other way right now, and I must say the food movement is beginning to flex its muscles. As we're seeing, these GMO labeling laws are popping up all over the country. Lots and lots of people are looking at taxing sodas or putting caps on sodas or doing other kinds of political interventions at the local level that could have a really large impact on people's health. I see politics as local right now.
Well, and that's something I just wanted to kind of emphasize and go back up a little bit. You know, you talked about the Congress. It seems to be the influence of money is endemic throughout government. It seems like, you know, we've been voting for Republicans and we've been voting for Democrats, and doesn't seem to matter which one we vote for, where they all take all of our money and leave us bankrupt. And, you know, the current administration, for example, is advocating that we drink more water and less soda pop, and even has an organic garden out in the backyard. And on the other hand, has hired Michael Taylor from the Monsanto Corporation to run the Food and Drug Administration, and they now seem to be, FDA seems to be, launching a food safety war against local food. So no matter where you look in government, it just doesn't seem to be working at all. And on the contrary, it seems to be taking us further down the road to perdition. And so we look toward local, and in the break, producer Kelly Bayer said, well, I'm not much of a political person, but I just believe that we should vote with our dollar. Your comment, Marion?
Yeah, I call it voting with your fork. Absolutely. And that's a very important thing to do. And certainly the vote with your dollar message has gotten across with respect to organics. Organic sales are booming. And I think there are lots of benefits to that. Farmers markets are booming. That's all vote with your dollar activity. But I think we need much more than that. We need to get real political power. And a lot of people voting with their dollars is not going to do that. It's going to help. And it's a very, very important step. Every single person who buys food at a farmer's market is helping some farmer to make a living. And if everybody in America who could would just spend a few dollars at a farmer's market, it would make a very, very big difference.
I have this in local
community agriculture.
I have this pledge that I've been pitching around the country called the 2x2 pledge. I think that if each and every one of us were to pledge to spend $2 per day on local food and talk to other people into doing the same thing, we could fix everything.
We could fix a lot. I absolutely agree, and I think that's a great campaign. But we need more than that, because the systemic problems that underlie our food system, like supporting the genetically modified agriculture system, if you want to put it that way, certainly supporting industrialized agriculture, is not an agricultural system that supports health. And I'm interested in having agricultural policy linked to health policy, and for that we need systematic, institutionalized programs that support fruit and vegetable growers.
Well, how do we do that? Who do we vote for? That will fix this?
Well, you have to start local and vote for local candidates where you have a real chance of getting somebody in locally who is going to be interested in these kinds of issues. I've kind of given up on national right now because, I mean, since the Supreme Court passed Citizens United, which was the Supreme Court decision that allowed corporations to give infinite amounts of money to electoral campaigns, the electoral system is now completely corrupted. And the amount of money
With all due respect, hasn't it always been corrupted? I mean, if you look at the numbers...
But never to this extent.
Well, I think, you know, when you look toward national politics, we see Republicans and we see Democrats. And irrespective of which party they're involved in, they seem to be both on the take. And they've been taking for so long that we're like, someone said, $200 trillion in the hole. So to me, that speaks to the fact that our national politics are totally bankrupt, and that we must, like producer Kelly Bayer suggests, start thinking really local. We're going to have to take a quick break, Marion, but when we come back, I'm going to ask you how we can go back to local and take care of ourselves and build a food system that is really good for our bodies and our souls and our communities. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson. Marion Nessel, she the author of Eat, Drink, Vote, which is a lot of fun. Right back. Well, there's a lot of power in Washington, a lot of money, and it seems like there's not much you and I can do to overcome the power of all that money, except to not need it. If we didn't need that money and we're reliant upon ourselves for good food, then that power of that money in Washington, D.C. would have no sway over us. Well, does that make any sense, Marion?
Oh, it certainly does. And I live in a Manhattan apartment with a terrace and I grow food on it. Why not? Everything I grow means I'm not buying. I've opted out of the food system.
Or you could buy food from the farmer's market or local farmer, a CSA.
And I do.
Yeah,
and I do. And we're blessed in New York to have amazing farmers markets all over the place, and I happen to live near the biggest one, which is very nice. But people can do that. I encourage everybody to grow their own food or grow a little. Tomatoes grown at home are always better than tomatoes grown someplace else. Even a window box is good for herbs. And teach kids how to cook. Those are two things I think would help a lot in changing the food system from within.
Absolutely. Teaching the joy of cooking and the joy of eating together.
Oh, all of those things. I mean, food is really such an extraordinary pleasure, and it links people, brings people together, has such important symbolic and cultural significance. These are all the kinds of things that I tried to talk about in this book of cartoons that just came out, and I hope it works.
Now, do you think, you know, the book is titled Eat, Drink, and Vote. Do you really think that we can vote our way to good food?
Well, I think eventually we'll have to. We're at a very unusual period in American history right now, and we know that history goes in cycles. So this particular government structure isn't going to last forever. And I think what you have to do is build up enough grassroots support so that you're ready when there's a political change that allows some good things to happen.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, you know, we seem to be heading in the same direction with respect to how we see the world in a politics of food. It seems to be like we're both of the mind that our national politics will be insufficient to allow us to survive, and that we somehow must turn to our local communities to rebuild, essentially, a food infrastructure. Is there an alternative?
No, I think it's the best place to start. You do it where you are. If you don't have a farmer's market in your community, start talking to farmers and see if you can have one. Go into your kids' school and see what kind of food they're eating. I've just known so many people who have worked on school food who have made miraculous changes.
Mm-hmm.
I think schools are just an incredibly important place to start.
And what about the notion that producer Kelly Bayer brought up, where you take your dollar and you go to the supermarket and you make your vote as to how you want your food?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think that's enormously important. And then, if you can, or if you're interested, take it to the next step and try to make sure that that people who don't have access to healthy food get access to healthy food, and try to change the system so it becomes easier for everybody to eat more healthfully and more sustainably.
That from Professor Marian Nessel, she the author of Eat, Drink, and Vote, and the cause of much trouble in the food chain, I'm sure. Thank you, Marian. Appreciate it.
I do my best. Thanks. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.